Yeah, thank you very much, Mrs. Bucci.
I will try to have to make a statement now, and let's play with it. First thing that comes to my mind in the whole sequence of your lecture, where you describe how, you know, Foucault is taking what is there at his time, trying to break it up, trying to take parts out of it and replace it with more vivid associations, like saying an object or a piece of art is not a storage of crystalline knowledge, which is fixed. We often also have in classical archaeology the notion that we have, you know, we can say we have sculptures or take everything you like, and these are more or less storages of information. There is something fixed. Even there is, it is our interpretation to say they tried to fix something. It was the intention of the culture that we are trying to do research upon, to fix things. Roman culture, Roman imperial culture is always trying to fix things as long as they can be, you know, stored in stone. And that's not only a notion of the researcher, but some researchers believe that this is also the real interest the Romans had, trying to fix things in stone, to come clear with some things to an extent where you can fix it in stone. So it's very interesting to see this being turned around by Foucault and then handing it over more or less to Kubler, who is again taking things like, what did you say, like was very clear that you have states of, what was that in?
About?
No, it was formal states.
Okay.
That Foucault is making of styles, you know, he replaces
historical
terms,
styles.
He replaces terms with other terms, trying, you know, to open up something, and Kubler takes this and replaces it again with systematic age and something like
that. I think so.
yeah, probably that would be an interesting line to follow. On the other hand, I can only say that I'm very sympathetic with what the organizer said about trying to look if this can be applied to real material culture again, if it can be reapplied, because this whole thing claims to start with concrete objects and concrete human contacts to artists, saying, I don't start from a formal system.
Yeah.
We just start, you know, from being very close to the artistic creation process and what is behind it, but becoming an overall formal system like all the others.
Yeah,
it is my ignorant feeling, and from there naturally I would like to. The problem I have with it is that it reminds me often to things where I could say, okay, yeah, that's something we have that too. But then I wonder how that would work. For example, with so interesting things like primary objects, then for each classical archaeologist, normally the thing comes up with copies and originals, saying what is the original, what was the copy. For example, we have more or less, let's say, 80% of Roman sculpture. Oh, no, that's not true.
Yeah.
Maybe say 60% because we have a lot of portraits, but also the portraits.
Okay.
Have originals. What was the original of the Augustus of Prima Porta? We don't have that. We don't know this. How did it differ from all the copies? Because that's an object, that's an original copy relationship in the same time, more or less, in the same time frame. While on the other hand, we have these Greek originals,
yeah,
and Roman copies, and they are not playing in the same time frame. Sometimes we have the originals too, like the Chorae of the Erechtheion, and a number of Roman copies, but most of the time we only have the copies. And so I think the one of the basic questions that should be resolved for me before I can understand that as a classical archaeologist would be to say, what are we talking about in terms of objects? Sometimes Kubler, to my mind, seems to talk about works of art, and sometimes he seems to talk about every possible thing that every possible human being may produce or use. And do we get that together? In classical archaeology, we absolutely don't get that together. Yeah. We have that kind of, and everything I say now is also only partially true, but we have that tradition of, you know, the antiquarians.
Yeah.
So the pre-Winckelmann times and the so-called early scientific approaches by Winckelmann. And so Winckelmann is post-antiquarianism, more or less. He changed some very, very important methodological approaches. And from there, you know, we are living in a split-up world in classical archaeology, because classical archaeology is doing what Winckelmann declared as more or less the works of art, the world of the works of art, and he has an historical approach to it. Combining it with Greek classical times, 5th century Acropolis of Athens.
Sure.
Something he wasn't able to recognize pieces from the 5th century in Rome. He recognized a lot of things, but what really was Greece was Greek, and what the Romans brought from Greece into Rome and what came into the hands of Winckelmann, he didn't recognize it. He was able to recognize the Roman things, the Greek stories in the Roman things, because that was close to the narration forms of Baroque, and that's what he was able to recognize. But in the end, he split the world up, and you can see this until the institutional setup of classical or of the archaeologies today, because the antiquarian thing, it went over to, let's say, prehistory, let's say, to provincial Roman archaeology, which is a subset more sometimes of prehistory, and into excavation archaeology.
Okay.
Where that is being, where in excavation archaeology, things are being done like the antiquarians did. You take pieces, not works of art, pieces from all day life, and try to put it into categories and make some sort of sense of it. Or even not, just, you know, put them away.
Yeah, I see.
And on the other hand, there is this whole discursive process that is playing inside of the works of art, and that goes to a point where even the works of art are being, you know, differentiated more and more. When we had a famous first director of the Roman station of the German Archaeological Institute, Ludwig Curtius, he's saying in his memoirs that he's now very unhappy with his fate, being nailed down in Rome to live with this kilometers of soulless looking copies, while in Greece, the Creto-Mycenaean culture is being discovered, and there the real thing is going on there. And so you see, even copies in classical archaeology are sometimes not worthy objects of art. Curtius was dreaming about the originals. Then in the 60s, there you know, something must have happened. Even if classical archaeology doesn't have a Kubler or a Fauquillon, because people tried to open up. There were things going on in prehistory, like the so-called American archaeology, which wasn't so much directed towards archaeology in America, but to certain methodological concepts applied to any sort of non-classical culture. And sometimes there was also in the idea of being able to get out of that Winkelmann trap, saying we are the science branch that is doing only objects of art or works of art, and getting to things like semiotics even in the 80s that came up. So in classical archaeology, there was probably a development which is in general not unsimilar to what happens in art history. But as far as I see it, it always goes along the lines of categorization of the objects you are talking about. And categorization, I mean, in a very primitive way, not making too much differences about many things, just saying, do we have objects of art? Then we are gone, we are stuck with them in classical archaeology, trying since the 60s, in a certain way, very remindingful to Kubler, to open up to something like material culture. Okay. But that sounds good. If you say we want to do material culture, we want to get out of that Winkelmann tradition. But on the other hand, that means that we have to be able to say meaningful things to objects which are not pieces of art. And that's my basic question line to your presentation. Does that apply to all kinds of material culture, what you say about Fauquillon and Kubler? Or is it more or less, you know, a spotted pattern where you can say, this is an expression of Kubler that applies clearly to works of art. There is an expression of Kubler that applies clearly to, let's say, very basic, very common objects without any art history in it, and it can't apply to a work of art. So I see some contradictory
It is contradictory in Fauquillon too. There is, I think, a big contradiction on this point. I will try to explain myself. I think that Kubler develops the Fauquillon idea of the materiality of works of art. It is a fact that for Fauquillon, objects, tools, and works of art are not the same thing. They are completely different, it is true. And it is clear to understand this because he was trained in a culture, in an artistic culture that was still the epiphenomenon or the Romantic Age in France. It was trained in art by his father, which was an artist himself, which was a printmaker. And thinking about this question of the prints, the etchings, the printmaking, we can understand the role of the copy, which is central in Fauquillon's mind. And I would say the principle which is at the basis of his artistic phenomenology is the material and the technique, the manipulation. The artist has an idea, but it's not the romantic notion of creativity, imagination, for example, like Baudelaire. For Fauquillon, the most important thing is the act of realizing a work of art. And it is this materiality and this technical aspect of his phenomenology of art, which has been inherited by George Kubler, I think. But Kubler, it is clear, he writes in the 60s, so the world has completely changed from the point of view of the archaeological research, the social sciences, ethnology, anthropology. So he develops this original idea of the materiality of the work of art. And I'm not a specialist of George Kubler, and I find that also in The Shape of Time, this difference between tools and works of art is not completely clear, solved. At least I have some problems with it, with understanding it. It is one of the most complicated books of the whole history of art of the 20th century, I think, and one of the most fascinating too. But I think that for both, for Sion and Kubler, maybe there is a moral reason for paying attention to tools, because tools, and as the works of art, have the best expression of the man. Foucillon writes during the 30s and the 40s in an epoch when a new notion of humanism is built up, le nouvel humanisme in France, for example, and the creations of men are the most important in the life, in the spiritual life. And I think that Kubler too inherits this moral conviction. It is important to show the answers of the man throughout his realization. The Homo Faber, he names Homo Faber, and Foucillon in his Éloge de la Man is completely the same. We know history throughout the forms, it is to say, throughout the man's skill, the man's realization, be that works of art and tools and objects. Many questions arises from your discussion. The first thing is the value of the copy, as I previously explained. For example, about the archaeology, it should be noted that Foucillon writes Videforme in 34 after his main researches about Romanesque culture of the beginning of the 30s, when he taught in the Sorbonne. And he was in a very close relationship with sculpture, with objects, and his main target was to give a provocative and alternative methodology of studying medieval sculpture in respect of the archaeological medieval archaeologists in France. So he refuses to give taxonomies, chronologies in itself, and he proposes his well-known formal analysis methodology. This is a first answer, provocative answer against medieval archaeology school in France. But from another point of view, in Videforms, he very rarely quotes other art historians or scholars, but one that he quotes is Valdemar Deonat, who was a very important archaeologist in Switzerland, in Geneva, and who wrote during the two first decades of the 20th century very important books. I don't know very well Valdemar Deonat, but since I can understand, a new form of archaeology was proposed. Where the difference between crafts, between objects and works of art was blended. They were blended in the name of a very spiritual, evolutionary idea of the creation of man. So Foucillon too had a strong interest to archaeologists, but this different new form of archaeology itself. And the last thing that I would like to add, that in respect to archaeology too, we must not forget that he trained for his dissertation with the etchings of Giambattista Piranesi, who was not only an artist, but an archaeologist, he too. And he tried to substitute a new form of archaeology investigation to the classical antiquarianism, if I correctly see. And at the basis, at the roots of Piranesi's investigation, there is Vico, Gian Battista Vico, and his vision of history, not only cyclical, but which is reposed on the history of things in a certain way to say. So this could be another route for this new interpretation. And then at the same time, Faucillon is strongly attracted by a different world. He considered the popular arts and the folklore a different thing besides works of art. But he was strongly interested because this permitted to him to better show his spiritualistic vision of life of forms, which is a history of art without names, exactly like Wölfflin's, but in a different way. And this is the reason why he was interested to sociological, ethnographical studies, and so on.
Okay, thank you very much. I think we can open up the discussion now to the other participants. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay, this is true. This is the reason why I choose to begin my paper with a reference to the German-speaking world of art history, and most of all to Viennese school of the end of the 19th century. There is a preliminary question. Did Faucillon know the German language? We don't know. He maybe managed a little, but we have to pay attention to the fact that he probably knew the German-speaking books throughout French translation. This is for Wölfflin, for example, for Riegel, but Riegel was much less known in France at the time than Wölfflin. And there is the first question, but it's undoubtedly he knew this revolutionary approach to art history, which has the two things at the same time, the materiality of objects like it is for Riegel, and the spiritual, a very strong spiritual interpretation of forms. And to stay again in the Viennese school, for example, Max Dvorak, for example, is the best example for this. And in relationship to the notion of form, I would say that the reading of Fiedler sull'attività artistica, le origini dell'attività artistica, the origins of the artistic activity, is one of the best, the well-known, the major books known by Faucillon, but where the clear separation of the form from content is shown, and where the autonomy of form is stated, even if Faucillon never quotes Fiedler, for example, and he instead quotes French scholars who are interested to the question of form. This is a large question that I try to study for my book. is that where was there at the time, at the beginning of the 20th century, an alternative notion of form in France itself, distinguished by the German-speaking world of art history? I think of yes. I think that during at the end of the 19th century, and during the epoch of the symbolism, a new notion of an operational notion of form arises in France, among the not the art historian, but among the art critics, among those persons who are in a very close contact with the works of art, and they most of all they use the notion of form in an alternative way, mostly empirical in respect to the German-speaking world of art. But anyway, it is sure that Fossillon is one who is well known in the German-speaking Kunstwissenschaft, and the, from a side of the question, it tries to develop the fruits of the German Kunstwissenschaft, but at the same time it tries to contrast the what he calls the abstractness of the German speaking, and he names Heinrich Wölfling among his major targets of discussion, and but undoubtedly these two roots are present in Fossillon's thought. I mean the material importance of the decorative art, for example, as it was for Riegel, and a vision of a spiritual life of forms, that they both were present in Viennese school, in the first Viennese school of the end and the very beginning of the 20th century.
Okay, other questions?
Thank you for your talk. You gave us a wonderful picture of intellectual history, actually. And I'm very happy that you put also Kubler in a kind of a flow of time. You put him actually again into the whole machinery of influences, of moving, of transferring, modifying, and things like that, from Fossillon, from Ranke, actually, to Fossillon, to Kubler, and even to Krakauer. What I would like to ask you, can you see the prime object, so to speak, in this intellectual history? That means in specific ideas of Kubler, can you see some ideas of Kubler which are prime object? Or do you actually don't accept it in your talk? That's would be my question. I'm asking that because you have mentioned Krakauer, who published his book a few years later, and he was speaking of the sequence of time, and he was more relating to Proust and in the idea of time. So is that would be a modification to think of both kind of flow of time and sequence of time and Kubler in between?
Okay, I have to say that I am not a philosopher, that I'm not a sociologist, and I don't know Krakauer very well. What was interesting to me was the fact that it is interest to note that Krakauer knows the shape of time thanks to Erwin Panofsky. There are some letters Panofsky suggests to Krakauer to read The Shape of Time, and we know the tie between Panofsky and George Kubler himself. But some years after, Krakauer discovers Fossillon, evidently throughout Kubler, as I himself did, for example. And I'm not able to give you an answer about the prime object question, but what was interesting to me was precisely the interest, Krakauer's interest in the shaping of time offered by Kubler and by Fossillon himself. He is really interested to the possibility to grasp discontinuity of art, of history itself, not of history thanks to the forms, thanks to the art history. This is the central question that I would like to underline. There is a moment in the history of art, in the history of the disciplines, when the art, and there is, it is probably in Vienna at the end of the 19th century, the art history becomes the main discipline, the main historical discipline. Okay, thank you. Thanks to the notion of form or to the notion of image, and we can think about Abi Warburg, for example, we can read in another way the continuity or the discontinuity of art history. And I think, for the very little that I know by Krakauer, that he was attracted by this idea that a new vision of history was originated by art historians and not by historians themselves. And but about your question, your specific question about prime objects, I'm not very able to answer to you because I don't know very well Krakauer's thought. Anyway, what seems interesting to me, for example, in respect to the relationship with Erwin Panofsky, is this shifting from the image to the form. The origin is the same, and we could talk about Jakob Burckhardt and this idea of a continuity, is a statization of history, and this idea of recurrent forms in the time and in the course of art history. And the idea of image was inherited by Abi Warburg, and Panofsky himself is mostly attracted by the notion of image. And the question arises of the relationship between classical, Renaissance, and the Middle Ages, between the two, there is a big question. And I'm convinced that Faucillon refused the notion of semantic image because he was trained in medieval art history, and probably with the folk arts too. So he substitutes the notion of form to grasp the survivance, the continuity of art history, at the same time the discontinuity. In fact, George Kubler is very lucid when he states that the principle of disjunction, which was well discussed in 1960 by Erwin Panofsky, but we know that the first ideas of this principle in Panofsky too date about the 40s, okay, even if before. But Faucillon too, in Vie des Formes in 34, it gives a plain definition of the principle of disjunction. And the source is obviously the distinction between form and content. And he understands, like Panofsky, at the same time, maybe at the same time, I do not say later, but I argue that Panofsky and Faucillon, they met in 1932, and I like to think, to suppose, that they talked about this question of the relationship between form and content at the principle of disjunction. And in Vie des Formes, as in the later text of Erwin Panofsky, it is well stated. But for Faucillon, it is not the image with a precise, significant, precise meaning, and always indebted to a classical tradition, the humanistic European-centered tradition. On the contrary, he substitutes the notion of form, which is more large and maybe better suited to understand the discontinuity of history, of art, history itself.
I'd like to thank you very much for the wonderful paper on Faucillon. I think in a world where so many scholars have anxiety of influence, Kubler never experienced that with relationship to Faucillon. And I think that he constantly mined his very first experience with Faucillon for primary objects. Mm-hmm. Ideas that he could then, years later, as they became useful to him, elaborate. That didn't mean that he agreed, but that they were fuel for thinking about a problem. And I've seen, until his death, excuse me, I've never heard him stop reflecting on the importance of Faucillon's thought. On the question of archaeology, it's very interesting that in 1937, Carl Lehmann wanted Kubler to join him and wanted him to do a dissertation in archaeology. And Kubler resisted. But when he joined the American School of Archaeology, a lot of the ideas about tools and useful objects versus works of art were forced upon him because the dirt archaeologists, anthropologists, not classicists, insisted on the value of mean form in pottery shards that would show very slow, constant evolutions, which allowed them to date things. When Kubler used what the dirt archaeologist called fancy forms, meaning art objects which somehow didn't obey those rules, to date, he was severely criticized. And yet he always knew he needed both tools. But I do think that it was an uneasy relationship even for him to reconcile whether that was a gradient back and forth, or whether they were two separate categories.
Yes, in direct response to this, also the use of signals as a metaphor has impressed me, thinking about parts of archaeology that I'm not competent to say anything about it. Prehistoric objects. We had this Oscar Montelius in 19th century, who was probably the first and the last person from this field of research trying to put up a theory to the so-called typological methodology he had. And that even things which are tools, which are not objects of art, which probably don't require an expression about an abstract problem that maybe
an intent.
But were just, you know, tools, and they are made over time in tens and hundreds and thousands of years. There is a pulse of change in them, and this pulse of change probably doesn't mean that those tools are getting better and better. Mm-hmm. The older tools are did their job too, more or less. You can't see by analyzing them in each step a real embeddement of the tool. You just see the change happening. And he uses the so-called, because we don't have any sort of, you know, written chronology, written commentaries to the object. So archaeologists are always very fanatic to get into the rules of chronology, as you said it, and they naturally don't accept worlds or ideas of worlds where this change doesn't happen, because then they can't do their chronology anymore. He uses the so-called closed contexts or closed findings, saying all inside of such a closed context is being deposited at the same time, and then they try to make the chronology by connecting those closed deposits. But he was also, you know, very close to the idea that there is a constant change of form, which probably isn't just being, you can't just make a reason of it by saying these tools are getting better. That's not the case, but the change, the pulse of change is there, and that's probably very close to what Kubler says, that there are signals going out. And sometimes, naturally, you can say, okay, with the Greek sculpture, the contrapost or something, that's a problem we understand, and that's a work on the problem we understand, and in art history, that may be the same. But in prehistoric objects, also in object worlds that don't apply to that level of abstraction,
these things happen. And so normally I understood Kubler as opening up and getting also, you know, things into the whole view that in Europe are being separated. First by Winckelmann and the antiquarians, yes. Then by, as you say correctly, dirt archaeology and classicist archaeology, which don't share too much of common views, and that was a great merit of Kubler to say, let's try again and probably also try to go back to the 19th century where we had people who tried to see it all.
Okay.
Who weren't afraid to start thinking in that direction. Okay, next questions.
Thank you.
Yeah, I may be a little bit off. I start with the complaint. The complaint is actually that I want to say I catch up with this conference.
I'm sorry, I'm much more slowly because.
Okay.
Sorry.
I want to start with a sort of a complaint, just to reorganize in a sense. You will understand what I mean. I catch up with that conference because of the very title. It says The Shape of Time. So first what I did, I ran in the bookstores and asked all the people, can I get that book, to the organizer? Till this day, I didn't get this fucking book first. Not in German, not in English, not in French. There's no chance. You said it's an important book. Now, I start with a second confession. The confession is, I'm not from this faculty. I'm actually studied physics. The reason why I studied physics was I want to understand what the hell is time. That's what we physicists then turn into relativity theory. And I want to understand what is light. That's why I study quantum mechanics and quantum theory. We all use that fine word, time. And I saw this by this French fellow and by this. Yeah, I think he was German. And they all use this word time. It seems to be there's nothing better out there to use that very word. Now, what is it? Is it a word? Is it a concept? Is it a metaphor? What we actually have here in front of us. Now, since Kubler had been at Yale, there was another famous great man. He's not known among you, maybe. Henri Margonneau. My question is, did Kubler ever talk to physicists and mathematicians about what is time, because he used that word? Was it just a sloppy usage of, well, there's nothing better out there? Was your attempt to say, now we are very clever, smart people, and we just avoid using time because we don't want to explain what time is. Mm-hmm. And then we come up with something we call it form. That was your starting comment about encoding. So what are we doing here now, actually? Are we jumping from one word to another word, and in between we formulate it in metaphors? Yeah, that's why I turned to that conference, because I thought, well, that's great, now I maybe get an idea of the shape of time. I was not able to read the thoughts. What you put down there on the screen was very powerful. At the very end, I give you a suggestion. You should speak at the Institute for Advanced Study in Princeton. But then you shouldn't talk to the artists there. You should talk to physicists.
It's a good suggestion. Thank you for the suggestions. But I confess that about the relationship of George Kubler with his contemporary physics, I think that Professor Ries will give a much more better answer. Regarding to Faucillon, the question of the definition of time is a very large question, but it was a very large question at his time, at the time, at the beginning of the 20th century in France too. The biggest reference is to Henri Bergson philosophy. It's a very old story, but which is inherited in the 30s by Henri Faucillon, because he several times makes reference to, I don't know, I asked to myself whether Faucillon was acknowledged with contemporary physics, quantum physics, and so on. I'm not trained in this subject at all, but I think that it could be acknowledged of the innovations of the physics of the time, but always not in a direct way, only throughout philosophers and so on, I suppose. But we do not have any concrete element to establish this. Anyway, another thing that I would like to stress is that in respect to Bergson's philosophy, it is fascinated. Bergson's philosophy, idea of time, is at the basis of his own idea, but with several different points of distinctions. And for example, the large role which is given to space as an alternative notion to time. For Faucillon, a work of art, he was an art historian, we should not forget it. And the form is special before being a time notion. And another thing is that he probably was fascinated of the question of the representation of time, not so much by the Evolution Creatrice, Matière et Mémoire, the works of Bergson himself, but maybe by contemporary paintings, works of art. I speak about the impressionistic paintings, where the problem of the resolution of forms in time and space was evident. And Henri Faucillon writes in 27 a large history of paintings in Europe in the 19th and 20th century. And the pages dedicated to the impressionist masters are full of observation about the form in time and space. And it was not the only one. Even the Vienna school, we all know that was fascinated by impressionism. And Wölfflin himself is throughout the paintings of the moment and the revolution of the impressionism, and when it is clear, and the further developments, I think, for example, to Cubism. And this is throughout the actual paintings that art historians and art critics are questioned about the relationship of space and time in the forms. But about physics, I cannot give you an answer. I'm convinced that Professor Rees will do.
Is this working? Since I'm not an organizer, I can say you have to tempt you to stay until the last talk. And Ellen Levies, who I'm sure will talk a great deal about the interest and connections between Kubler and particularly Gerald Holton's article in Daedalus on complementarity and Niels Bohr, and even later his interest in mathematics. But when he wrote The Shape of Time, he was not reading quantum physics nor much mathematics. But by 65, 66, he was.
One could add to...
I make one comment for you that might be of interest, is to read Linda Henderson's book, nothing to do with Kubler, but everything to do with what artists were aware of in physics and Einstein, and goes into the question of what could be represented. Because I think that will give some of the relationships that you're asking about.
Basically, one could say, at least for archaeology, that we are always looking for easy metaphors, things who make things, if we use them, things must get clearer, and we don't need metaphors, or we couldn't handle metaphors who make things even more complicated. But to bring it to another extreme, I could also quote one archaeological paper of the 80s, which is not being titled The Shape of Time, but the face of time, mm-hmm. or the faces of time. There was an interesting article of Paul Zanker, who was trying to show how, let's say, in the space of 10 so-called years, in a decade or so, sometimes also in shorter periods or in longer periods, but in a shared period where hundreds, thousands of individuals share the same period, they tend to look more or less in a way that makes the image recognizable. And that, or recognizable in terms of chronology, looking at faces from the early 70s, for example, I know these are the soccer players of Germany who won the World Championship in Munich, and it's the same time of, let's say, Led Zeppelin, for example. I don't know why I see that, but I see it. And the same holds true for Roman portraits, let's say, of the early Augustan time. And Zanker is trying to put this to an extreme, saying not only we don't need to have the whole set of forms to make clear what the form of a certain time is, even if we use the word time in an unreflected manner, but saying we can narrow that down to the face, you know. And in the end, I mean, I also remember the 70s where people, for example, like Chuck Berry were put down because he wasn't a great blues philosopher, who said blues is something which is only a piece of music in 12-part Breschen without any kind of theory about that. And there were many complaining about that, but I think he did a lot of very good songs. And I think we can do that too, even if we don't know what time is or how difficult or dangerous it would be to start think about what time is. Then probably we would stop with all things we do. But I don't know if that would be progress. Okay, we have 3 minutes to the break.
One remark and one question, because at the beginning you raised the question about the difference between art and other objects, and I'm not sure if this is really a problem in Kubler's essay, but because maybe it's more a problem which lies in the objects and their different function in different times, I'm not sure. But my question is, I would like to know, maybe you could tell us something about the reception of Kubler in Italy or in France, because you're the expert and nobody else could answer this question.
For the France, I don't remember the date of edition of the French edition of The Shape of Time. For Italy, it is clear, because the first edition, Italian edition, appeared, if I remember well, 10 years after, in 72, in Audi Verlag, which was the most, and which had edited Life of Forms by Fossillon. And with a foreword by Giovanni Previtali, which was a professor of art history in Siena University, a very classical like background. He was a specialist of medieval art history, but with a strong political accent. For what Previtali tries to say this is my opinion, is that Kubler is a revolutionary book, Shape of Time is a revolutionary book because it is Marxist, just because it insists on objects and on sequence and so on. I think that, and we also have to recall that in the journal Prospettiva, which is a very important journal of the Siena University, I don't know if at the time it was directed by Previtali himself, Previtali publishes translated History or Anthropology of Art with a long commentary by himself, always in this path of Marxist reception of the Shape of Time. But it was normal at the moment for Italy cultural situation at the mid of the 70s because of the political situation too of Italy itself. And anyway, after that, Kubler has been really forgotten in Italy, I have to say this. And even in the most recent publication about aesthetics, question of art theory, Focion is several times quoted, but Kubler not. Maybe also among the Focion's pupils, Focion's students, it was a little forgotten after the crash of the 80s in Italian cultural situation. And maybe because of political situation too, I don't know. It is a fact that Einaudi Verlag editions have changed their agenda, and it is not a case, not for chance. But I am also convinced that this strongly political interpretation by Previtali was a sort of mystification, or I would say a limitation for a good understanding of a book, of a capital book like The Shape of Time. Anyway, it was important at the time, and it was like a heartquake for Italian art history, which was Roberto Longhi art history, okay? I don't know if I can explain myself, which was a philological, okay, art history most of all. So the publication of a book like Shape of Time was really a heartquake. And on the contrary, Focion is different because in fact, Einaudi publishes, yes, the same year, 72 maybe, the same year of Kubler, the first Italian translation of La Vie de Forme, with a magnificent, let me say this, not because it was my professor, but a magnificent introduction by Enrico Castelnuovo, which was really penetrating and which opened up several paths of investigation in Focion understanding. And after this, Focion has mostly been studied by philosophers and aesthetics philosophers, not so much by art historians, just in the very last years. And this is what I'm trying to do, to underline that he was an art historian, he was not a philosopher of an aesthetician, not at all. Even if with many, many links with his contemporary world of philosophers at the Sorbonne, like Victor Bach and some others, for example. But I forgot, I'm a little tired, I forgot to say that the very first translation in Italian of La Vie de Fons date from the mid of the 40s, and thanks to Italian philosophers. This is the reason why of this philosophical reception of Focion's work.
Okay. Then we again have to thank you for sharing your rich knowledge with us.
Thank you to you all. Thank you very much.
Also, thanking the audience for participating in the discussion. I think we held our ground also in that respect. And the form or the shape of time will change now into a coffee break.